You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF.
And now, please join me in welcoming to the stage DeRay McKesson and Dan Pfeiffer.
All right. I've been here a couple times, and every time I find that video super intimidating.
Oh, this is incredible. That was, it's like a life goal is like make the video.
Yeah. I bring that up also every time I come here, and I'm still not on the video. So
awkward.
Hopefully you're going to help. I'm going to ride your coattails on that video.
We're going to do it together. Yeah.
First, this is a real pleasure for me because DeRay and I both have podcasts on Crooked Media. I have been participating in an interview with DeRay on Pod Save America. I have followed him on Twitter. I've read about him. I find him to be one of the most inspiring and interesting individuals in America. And I had never met him in person before tonight.
We just met. Yeah. So literally our first conversation, and you'll be a part of it.
Yeah. So hopefully
we just met.
It could be awkward. We'll see how it goes. All right. Let me start by asking you a question that is very freighted in the current times in which we live.
Okay.
How you doing?
Yeah, I'm okay. The world is falling apart around us, so like that is awkward. But I have a lot of hope. I think about like what it means to empower people, and I'm mindful that like I can't give anybody power, but what we can do is help people find the power they already have. And I feel like all across the country, it's like these people like finding power. They're like, I can do it. I can do it. I can do it. I can do it. Like that is what gives me hope in moments like this, even when the world is like crumbling, it seems, before us.
Just as like by way of introduction, kind of 3.5 years ago, I guess if I do my math, you were working in the school system in Minnesota.
Yep.
You went to Ferguson, and your life has changed completely.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about what drove you to drive to Ferguson and how you feel about your life in this new world. Like, I don't know that you ever expected to be in the place you are right now and what it means to you.
Yeah, so I was a senior director of human capital in Minneapolis Public Schools. I was responsible for all staffing. So like I was the person that hired everybody. So principals, custodians, teachers. And then Mike got killed. And I remember seeing it on CNN. I saw it on Twitter. And I was like, this is wild. I want to figure out what I can do. And then there was if any of you remember the National Moment of Silence, it was like August 14th-ish or something like that. I went to that in person in Minneapolis. And I was like, okay, I'm going to figure out what I can do. And August 16th was a Saturday. And I was like, I want to go, but I knew I couldn't call my father. So my father raised us. My mother left when I was 3. And my father's like, he's adorable, very sweet. But if I called him, he'd be like, don't go. So I was like, I can't call daddy. And my sister is like, I love my sister. My sister's name is Teray. We're not twins. We're just black from Baltimore. And she would be 50-50. Like if I got at the right time, she might say go, but like, I didn't know. So I was like, let me call my best friend, Donnie, who we've been friends for a decade, but he had just gotten married. And sort of our unspoken deal was like, I wouldn't call in the middle of the night because like, I like his wife and I didn't want to be that guy. Right. So I literally waited till like 7:55 and it's like, hey, he's like, Teray, what? And I'm like, I think I'm going to go to St. Louis. Like, what do you think? He's like, if you think you should go, you should go. And by then I'd already packed a bag. I'm like ready. I knew he'd probably say yes. So like, that was it. And I drove, it was 9 hours. I put this Facebook status up that said, I'm going to Missouri. I don't know anybody in the state of Missouri. If anybody can help me find like a spot to sleep, like let me know. And 7 hours in, I got really sleepy. I was in Iowa and I was like, I need to like go to sleep. So I found the church and I parked in front of the church and I like put some clothes over my head and I like just went to sleep for a couple hours. And then I woke up, like finished the drive and like the rest is history. But to the second part of your question, it's like, we knew that people cared about Ferguson, right? Like we didn't know that people were going to protest wherever they were. Like that was sort of something that we looked up and we were like, this is really incredible. But it took us a while to convince people there's a problem everywhere. Like people thought there was a crisis in Ferguson. They didn't think there was a crisis in America. Like that took us sort of a while. It was Freddie Gray and Sandra Bland and Walter Scott that finally got people to be like, okay, like something is wrong. And that was sort of wild to see people in other cities. And you're like trying to explain to them, like something's wrong in your place. And they're like, no, just St. Louis. And you're like, no, it's like where you are. Yeah. There's a new study that came out like 2 weeks ago, that one of their conclusions is that a third of the people killed by strangers in the country are actually killed by police. That is wild. Yeah.
You know, I just saw this in your Twitter feed today, but San Francisco passed a new set of rules around police violence. Yes. And what are your thoughts about that? And do you think it's a model for, you know, what other cities should be doing?
I was nervous. I was like, what did I tweet today?
Yeah. We're going to go through your whole Twitter feed. Don't you worry.
This is what happens when it's like first time you're meeting. It's like, you can ask anything. So we did the first public database of police union contracts and use of force policies. And San Francisco has adopted all of the recommendations in the use of force policies, which is dope. So we wanted to try and figure out, like, what are the systemic levers, right? Like, what can we do? So there are a lot of use of force policies that don't actually say that deadly force is, like, the last resort. They're just like, you can use deadly force. And we're like, that's a problem, right, from a structural level. And even the police union contracts, there are union contracts that say things like the officer has to be disciplined in the least embarrassing way to the officer in the department. And you're like, I don't even know what that means, right? Like, what does that mean? Yeah. Places like Austin, they have a clause that says that people, like officers who are being investigated, get access to all the investigation files before any interrogation can happen. And it's like, no private citizen ever would get that, right? So we've been trying to like just show the activist community, because we believe if people had the information, they'd organize around it. And it's incredible to see places like San Francisco, places like Austin, cities across the country are starting to organize around these systemic things, because we believe that like the system is the only way that we change it.
And do you feel, San Francisco, Austin, two, particularly progressive cities in populace, right? And do you feel the conversation is moving in the right direction in other parts of the country on this matter?
I think so. It's interesting because some of this stuff feels like too hard for people, right? Like they think about, they're like police union contracts. They're like, I'm not an expert on police union contracts, so I can't do anything. So we've been trying to demystify this stuff for people, that like, politics is literally just a decision-making process, and you make a lot of decisions in your life every day. So like, you know how to be a part of a decision-making process. This is just like a different one, right? Like, how do we normalize the fact that people can have opinions about things? Like, that has been a hard challenge for us, I think, because some people just feel like they're not experts. But I do think that like across the country, people are starting to think about this differently. One of the things that I ask when I meet with mayors or like police chiefs, because I'll be in cities doing like other things, and then they'll find out I'm there, and like, they're like, can we meet off the record, right? It's like, okay, cool. And one of the things that I ask police chiefs, and you should ask police chiefs or mayors when you meet with them, is like how to file a complaint against the police. It's like one of the most fascinating things because none of them know. So I was in one person's office, and he's like, you do it online. I'm like, well, show me. He's like Googling like file a plea. Like, okay, that is like not, I'm not convinced you actually know. And then I'm like, well, where does the complaint go? He's like, the police department. I'm like, okay. Like, well, we're in the police department, right? And like, as in another city, and the police chief was like, when you file a complaint, somebody comes and visits your house. I was like, stop lying. They do not. Like, I know I'm not from the city. I've never, ever seen, like, policing here, but I know you don't send police out. Like, that is crazy, right? So that's been interesting to see people make these public commitments to change, but, like, some of the basic stuff, they actually, like, don't have an infrastructure around or haven't really thought about that. And it's like, if you can't file a complaint against police, and, like, I would bet that like there are other parts of the system that are also broken, right? That like we need to talk about.
And so, you know, if the progress is being made incremental, or maybe more so here in San Francisco at the local level, you know, how do you feel about the conversation at the national level? Because, you know, I was in the White House when Ferguson happened. I was there when President Obama brought the working group together. Yep. And, you know, actual substantive progress got made right away, but it did feel, at least in my very biased perspective inside the White House.
What role were you then?
I was the senior advisor back then. Okay. And that the conversation was starting to head in the right direction, and you had a president, you know, both on questions of police violence and then larger questions of criminal justice reform, systemic racism within the criminal justice system, that was starting to move in the right direction. And at least we're talking about it, right? And even some bipartisan discussion around sentencing and things like that. But here we are, you know, 3.5 years later, and Jeff Sessions, you know, Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch are not the Attorney General. Jeff Sessions is, whose main job seems to be finding all the things Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch did in undoing them. Right. There's certainly not a working group of police and civil rights activists with people from like yourself who were in Ferguson and Baltimore, other places, coming to the White House for a conversation. does that cause you just to focus your attention at the local level or think about Congress, or sort of how do you think about activism in this new world?
Yeah, I think about, so the longest meeting Obama ever had that wasn't national security was with us. And it was, I got arrested in Baton Rouge. I think about it because I got arrested in Baton Rouge and we met with him like right afterwards. And I was so upset. Like I just remember being mad at him and everybody. I'm like, yeah. I was in jail for 17 hours. I didn't do anything. But the longest meeting that he had in his 8 years was with protesters and mayors and police chiefs about these issues. One of the things that we learned sort of quickly is that there are 18,000 police departments. So there's not really like at the federal level, besides money, there's like not, there wasn't much that we could ask the administration to do besides like withholding money from the DOJ, withholding money from police departments. And they should have done that. In our last meeting, Obama started asking questions and like, it is unfortunate that that didn't happen and that it was slow. I do think the White House had planned for Hillary to win, so they were like doing this setup so that like she'd just come in and take it, and then that didn't happen. So
yeah, we all played that. Yeah.
Yes. It's interesting though, like literally, like after she lost, they scrapped all these meetings and it literally was like just convenings. You know, it was like I probably went to 5 convenings after Election Day where like they were just trying to get everybody in one room so we'd meet each other so that like there would be an infrastructure when the White House left. So 18,000 police departments, hard to figure out like what the one magic bullet would be at like the national level besides funding. The second thing is that like the structural things at the local level, like police union contracts, use of force policies, complaints, like probably have the biggest lever in terms of like the outcomes, right? Yep. And the third thing was data. So the FBI made the first commitment to track data, like of police killings in the country. Comey did. And the challenge with that though is that the 16 data, we won't get it till 18. So in America right now, any number that you've ever heard about police violence ever comes from newspaper reports. So if you get killed in America and a newspaper doesn't write about it, you're not in the data set, which is wild. So we say that like the numbers are being underreported, right? That like we can't guarantee that every single person's death is like picked up in the newspaper. Like we don't think that's true. It also is throwing off the race data a little bit because there's some towns in Texas where it looks like white people are being killed disproportionately more than people of color. But we think that what's happening is that people whose names are like John James and they're Latino, they're just being coded as white because their name's not Latino. Because the only thing that's being coded in the newspaper is like name and age. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. So like the databases are literally newspaper databases. And the administration could have been a more aggressive about that at the national level. Yep. So that's sort of the police angle. There are a lot of mass incarceration things that can totally happen through legislation, but with the policing, and you know, the administration did stop the 1033 program that was giving like MRAPs and all that stuff to police departments, but they just redid it. So, and I remember we were in a meeting with senior advisors to the president, and we asked like, so you stopped giving them the stuff, but like, what about the stuff they already have? Right? They don't need grenade launchers. Can you like take it back? And what they said, they were like, maybe we could have, but the Bush administration didn't even keep logs of what they sent to people. So like, they'd have to like just trust. They're like, please send us back the grenade launcher you might have. It's like, well, that's not going to work, right? Yeah. So we had asked for that, but like that just didn't, they couldn't.
More broadly, right? How, you know, as you mentioned in your first answer, that one of the things that keeps you hopeful in these dark times is that people are out there doing things, right? They're looking to make change in ways they can. And people who may not have been willing to do that before Trump, like it was sort of a wake-up call. Like, what advice would you give people who want to get into organizing activism, how to go about making change?
Yeah, I think, like, you know, Harriet Tubman didn't call me and tell me to, like, go to Ferguson, right? Like, I was like, I think I'm going to go. Feels like the right thing to do. And like, we'll figure it out. And like the first, you know, the first night it was like raining. We went to like a store, made like a poster, like stood in the street. That poster, like I'd hopped 2 fences that night. So it was like that poster. I don't even know where that poster is. That poster did not live very long. But that was like our first, the beginning was like not very sexy. It was like a lot of sweat, a lot of hard work. And then we built up from there. And I think that some people, like, because you don't see that hard part, you only see the, you know, I had 800 followers when the protest began. I have almost 1 million now, but like back then I had 800 and we just like, we worked every day and tried to like get the message out, you know? So like start where you are, I think is important. I have more advice about like things to avoid. So I think,
well, that's good too.
I think about, some people have made pessimism cool in this moment, that like, it's like cool to not have hope. It's like, well, you know, and people say like, if you have hope, then you don't really understand America. Like that sort of narrative, I think does a lot of damage. And I think about it in terms of Peter Pan. If you remember the movie Hook, remember when Peter couldn't fly because he stopped believing, you know? And I think about we're in one of those moments where like, we'll never build a better world if you don't believe that like we can ever do it. And there's some people who their gift is like finding the flaw, right? So they're like, everything's flawed. I'm going to find the flaw. And because they're really good at finding the flaw, they never offer an affirmative idea about the world because everything's flawed, right? So if they offer an affirmative idea, that must be flawed. And then it's like this cycle. And like, I think that that is like a crazy sort of way to think about the world. That like, we have to have people putting out real ideas and dreaming. And the vast majority of things that we go to are like all about the problem, right? It's like, you've been to a million panels and talks where we talk about how bad the world is. And it's like, what can we do about it? We're like, pray. And it's like, well, that's not right? Like, this is like, we have to, there have to be some solutions that we can think about. So we're about that. There's some people who are more interested in fighting than winning. Like their identity is like rooted in the battle. So when the battle goes, they like don't know what to do anymore. And I think we found that in the movement. It's like you sit down at some policy tables and people like just don't even want to do it. They just like, can't imagine like not having to battle the person on the other side. And we're in this moment where like, for better or for worse, people want to be heroes around this work, right? Like, so I can think about, I was at one jail, and in this jail, they still, we were doing a visit, and they still wrote on the inmates' wrists with Sharpies, like the order by which they had to go see the judge, right? So I see it, and I'm like, that is wild. So I go see the sheriff, and I'm like, hey, you're still writing on people, it's 2017. And he's like, it really was like that. I was like, hey, can we talk about that writing you're doing on people? And he was like, can't defend it. It's dehumanizing. We need to change it, right? It was simple. We like didn't have a battle. He was like, I'm going to change it. 10 days later, his team texted me being like, we're testing out paper wristbands. And it was like, I didn't need to go in there ready to fight him. We just needed to like have a conversation about it, right? I think there's some people who like can't imagine a space that you're not like in battle mode with people. And I worry about what that looks like.
You know, part the flip side to you becoming a, you know, such a prominent person in the context of the activism you're doing, you know, the protests coming out of Ferguson and Baltimore and elsewhere, is you've also become a target of the right. You know, you probably hear your name on Fox News a decent amount. You've had
Fox News.
Yeah. we can have a conversation about Fox News if you want. And, you know, you've been sued by police officers. How have you responded to that? How does that make you feel? And, you know, and what is the status of those lawsuits, if you can talk about them?
Yeah, I try to be, you know, I'm mindful. I remember the last time I thought I was going to die in the protest. It was early. It was like August of 2014. And in the early days, we used to run with our hands up, like as a sign of like, we're not armed. And it was like in the very early days. And you, unless you were there, I don't know if you'll be able to appreciate it, but the police were always by cars in the beginning. Like, it's so vivid to me, but when I say it, I feel like it comes across weird, but they were never just like roaming across the street. They were like always by a vehicle. And then like one night they weren't. And like, I'll never forget it. They were just like everywhere. And you're like, but I thought you stood by cars. And so they started coming towards us, which we hadn't. It was like one of the first times they'd done that. And we all ran. And I remember running, and I was running through, I had to run through like a set of police officers to get to my car. And I was wearing these like hoop shorts, and I had an iPhone charger, and it was like falling out of my pocket, but I was running with my hands up. And I'll never forget like the moment of being like, do I like grab the cord or do I not? And like, I was like, okay, this is bad. And I went home that night, and I was like, I remember how the fear felt. And I was like, I got to figure out what to do with the fear, because like, if I can't be that afraid and go out, like, I just like won't be able to manage it. And I think about that with like the threats, is that they want us to be too afraid to continue doing the work. So I try to like stay focused about it and be mindful of safety, but not be too afraid to do it. So I am being sued. There are four lawsuits, two in Dallas. Remember those five officers got killed in Dallas? I'm being sued by two of their families. And then I was being sued by two officers in Baton Rouge. One guy got hit by a rock the night that I got arrested. And then one guy got shot like a week. I wasn't even in Baton Rouge. It was like a week later. I wasn't in Dallas either, by the way, but
seems like a critical point of evidence.
Yeah. It's like I wasn't really there. But the Baton Rouge one, both got dismissed, which was great. We sued Baton Rouge for for the unlawful arrest, and we settled. We actually closed the settlement out at the end of the month, which I'm very excited about. We were in jail for 17 hours. It was like a long time for us. They made us put on like jumpsuits. You're like, I'm getting out. You know, it's like, I'm not going to be here that long. Like, why are we in jumpsuits? So that was sort of wild. I think about the first person ever permanently banned from Twitter was Chuck Johnson, because he did that tweet that was like, please donate to help me take out DeRay. So like, that was sort of wild. I did a talk back at a movie theater, like for the Panthers documentary, and somebody tweeted, like the day before, he tweeted like, I'm gonna shoot you, like a shooting threat. And I get this text from the organizers being like, do you want to cancel it? And I'm like, no, I think we'll be cool. And there was like there were three troll accounts that probably were the Russians. Yeah. So I can't really see them. But they like trolled us like from day like 15 all the way through, right? And this was that threat was a variation on it. So like, I had experience with this troll. But the organizers were like freaked out about it. So we go to the movie, like theater's the theater. We're like watching the movie, and literally out of a TV show, like all of a sudden the lights come on, the police come in, they shut down the whole movie theater. We have to leave. It was like a whole thing. And then we asked them, could we just finish the movie? So they let us just stay. It was just like a thing. Mm-hmm. And the people around me get freaked out about it. I try to like stay pretty calm about it, but people were freaked, you know, because it was like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. This whole, huge movie theater just was like closed because they said they were gonna kill me. So I try to be thoughtful and not too freaked out. My phone did get hacked, and that was like that was weird. I was on a panel, and it was one of those panels. You know, you go to a panel and you're like, I can't wait for this to be over. It was one of those sort of panels.
He's not thinking that right now.
Hope those people aren't watching. But I finished speaking, and I normally travel with like two or three phones, one that I always have one, and then like a couple in my book bag. And this day I had two like in front of me, and this, the phone that I use all the time, all of a sudden I look down and the screen's like, please activate your cell phone. And I'm like, I've never seen that screen before. It must be like, I don't know, frozen or something. Mm-hmm. So I like turn it off, turn it back on. And it's like, please activate your cell phone. I'm like, this is so weird. Like, what happened to my phone? And then I have this moment where I'm like, oh my God, I think my phone got hacked. So on the other phone, I text some people at Twitter and I'm like, please lock my account. Like, I can't get on anything, right? But I'm just like, and I'm supposed to be on this panel. So I'm trying not to freak out, but like, you know, so I'm texting everybody. And then come to find out is that somebody called Verizon. You can actually change a SIM card over the phone, which like I didn't even know that was possible. They tried to change my phone number over the phone, which you could only do in person, thank God. So they did that, and then they reset all my passwords so that the two-factor went to a device that they could control. So they got into my Twitter account and my Gmail, and it took like, I don't know, probably 5 or 6 hours for me to get it back. So somebody tweeted like, I endorse Donald Trump, like that was like the thing.
Yeah, that was not a good use of the hacking your phone.
Yeah, it's like, and then I get these texts from reporters being like, can we have a comment about Trump? And I'm like, my phone got hacked! So in that night, which is wild, I don't talk about this much publicly, but that night I get this text from a hacker who's like, hey, DeRay, I'm a good hacker. Like, da da da. And it's like, well, you already have my number, so we might as well talk, right? Because, like, you already know who I am. And he's explained to me, like, how they got the last four of my social. He's going through this whole thing. And then he's like, you don't have to believe me, but like, here are all of your credit card numbers. It was like one of the craziest texts I've gotten. And he had great advice, but it was like, that was a little awkward. Yeah. So I've sort of given up, like I know people might be watching. I get it. It's okay. You know, like we are right in this work, you know, and like being right keeps me like grounded about this.
I would say people in tech world out here are very snobby about cybersecurity, and if you don't have two-factor, they yell at you. So I'm glad you explained it that way, because when I was doing my very serious preparation for this interview, there's an article about cybersecurity that says DeRay McKesson did everything right and still got hacked.
See,
so
I did. And I'll tell you, you know, it's funny, Jack is a friend, and Jack was like, DeRay, if you have two-factor, da-da-da-da-da-da. So when my thing got hacked, his reply to my text was like, did you have two-factor? And I'm like, my stuff got hacked, Jack. And then his account got hacked, and I was like, see? That's what you get. See? Yeah. You tried it. That's what you get. Yeah.
Speaking of Twitter, and this may be an awkward question since you're friends with Jack, but Twitter's obviously been a very important organizing tool and a way of getting your message out and talking about key issues. But it's also been, there's a flip side to that too, right? Yeah. It has been, you know, in a lot of ways, it's been used by people organizing for much, you know, all, you know, the people who organized, you know, the white supremacist marches in Charlottesville. It is a place where people will say things, racist things, misogynistic things they would never say elsewhere. So how do you sort of think about Twitter in the context of public you know, public and political discourse in 2017?
Yeah, I think about Twitter as like the friend that's always awake. That's like how I've always thought about Twitter. So like I tweet like I need new deodorant. That is a tweet. And
it's that's like, my next question.
And it's like Trump is wild, right? Like All of those things are real. And that's like why I tweeted so much in Ferguson was like I literally knew nobody in the state of Missouri. So it's like I needed to tell somebody, and Twitter was like the somebody that I was telling. So that's like still how I think about it. I think that the obvious hate, all the platforms will get better at. So like Facebook will get better, if not only because like the PR is going to be so bad at some point. I'm more interested about the private stuff. So like when we met with Sheryl Sandberg a week ago, and it's like there are Instagram accounts that have like 200,000 followers that are private, but that are hate accounts. Like they are like literally like white supremacist accounts. And when you build a platform that is predicated on people reporting it, like how do you report a private account, right? Like what does that, I don't know. And they don't know either. And I think that sort of stuff will be the bigger questions later. Like I think that Twitter's biggest challenge, and I've said this to them, is that they don't talk about safety. Like it's weird to have a platform that you would say like builds the world's conversations and you won't engage in a conversation with people about this. Like that is sort of odd, yeah. Right? That everything that they do about safety is like pushing out things to you. They're not like, I don't know what the mechanism is that they're like actually engaging in a back and forth with people. And they have like the Trust and Safety Council, which is probably an incredible group of policy people. I'm like not convinced that there are people impacted by any of the speech on the platform. Like I've said that to them too. So, but I think that stuff will probably figure itself out. I'm more interested in like the private accounts, like the Russian bots, like that whole piece. It's like a little more insidious.
Yeah. It seems dangerous. You know, this, hopefully nothing bad happens with that. I think this is a little anecdote that goes to, I think this is a true story about how available you are on Twitter is that, Rembert Brown, who is a writer, used to write for Grantland. He interviewed President Obama on President Obama's flight to Selma for the anniversary, landed, realized he didn't have a return ticket on Air Force One, and he tweeted, I think...
We did. We drove him back.
Tweeted, he's like, I don't know how to get back, and then you responded, and I think he said, how do I find you? You said, I would be the one in the vest.
Yeah. I did not say that. I was hot in Selma. I don't even know if I wore the vest in Selma. It was so hot that day. But we did drive him back because, like, we had an extra seat in the car, and, like, he was on Twitter. Yeah. I met a lot of people on Twitter, like Snowden. I know Snowden because of Twitter. I was watching Citizen 4, and I was tweeting about it, because I don't know why I watched Citizen 4, but I watched it. And his team reached out and was like, I would like to talk to you, you know? And I was like, so we're like DMing on Twitter. And then I meet him, and he can, you know, he's in Russia. So like U.S. government, I did not see him in person. But he can control this like robot thing from Russia. So we like had a conversation. It was great. And like I met him. I met so many people, like literally, or like we set up that meeting with Bernie. Like the meeting we had with Bernie was like, I tweeted to Bernie being like, we meet. And his team was like, we will meet you. Like, okay. Yeah. So Twitter's been like incredible in terms of like opening up space and just like cutting through the middle ground. I had breakfast with Chelsea Clinton. We like DM'd on Twitter about it. I was just telling you beforehand, I just saw Chelsea Manning the other day, and like, Chelsea's team, and Chelsea would send messages when she was in jail. So like we talked then, and you know, she's out now, so like Twitter is like how we know each other, you know.
I remember in an early Crooked Media meeting where you had just started your podcast. Pod Save America was like in its third week, and we were going over like guests to come, and we're like, well, we might get this congressman from Massachusetts, and you know, maybe one of our old Obama people will join. And they're like, who does DeRay have? And like, Edward Snowden. we're like, all right, he came to play.
Ed was great. He was.
That was a fascinating conversation.
I'd asked him, I like sent him a message before Comey got fired. Yeah. And it just like happened to be, it was like perfect timing. And Ed's family was coming to visit him in Russia, which like, I was like, I didn't know your family could come visit you in Russia. But, and it like just worked, you know, it was like the timing was great. I asked him, I think, I don't know if we did this on the podcast or if it made the podcast or not, but I asked him what it was like, did he miss America? You know, like, what was that like? And he was like, you know, I live on the internet, and I've always lived on the internet. So he's like, I want to be home, but like, I'm sort of home in a different way. You know, I was like, that was interesting. Yeah. He totally, if you've listened to that episode or if you've ever talked to him, I don't know.
Which, I mean, I'm sure he could be at the Inform anytime now.
No, he might be.
Tweet at him, see what happens.
He like totally is like the computer guy. You know, he's like the computer guy. And if any of you, I mean, this is San Francisco, you might be the computer
guy. They might all be the computer guy, yeah.
Awkward. But yeah, no, he's like the computer guy.
Yeah.
You're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
Switching topics for a second, Colin Kaepernick and what's happening in the NFL. I wanted to sort of get, you know, because people here have followed it.
I met Colin on the internet.
See, I knew this was going to end that way. But obviously San Francisco, you know, this was sort of the center when it was just Colin Kaepernick protesting very specifically around police violence and systemic racism. And we're in a very different world now. You know, it's become this huge... Trump has turned it on its head. It's become a question about a whole bunch of other things. I just wanted to get your view of, you know, sort of what the of Colin's decision to protest, and then how the issue has turned, you know, now that Trump has sort of nationalized it in a way.
Yeah, it's, you know, the story of Colin is interesting because I like literally don't know if anything new can be said about it, right? It's like every article is literally, it's like the same argument, just like rehashed, yeah. So I won't do that here. I will say what is interesting about Colin himself is that Colin is like even nicer and sweeter and more amazing than like you've ever seen on TV. He's just like a good person. So when anybody meets him, they're like even more committed to the cause because he's like, he's not just like this sort of, I don't know, well-meaning football player. He's like actually like a really good guy, which is not to be taken for granted. I do think that the message got lost with Trump, right? Yeah. And Trump's really good at making every message about himself. And Colin's silence, there's a question for some people whether that is like working for him or against him, and like who are the surrogates right now who can like help make the message work. Yeah, it's like hard. I think that if I was going to write an essay, it would be called like Too Proud to Beg, because the reality is that they want Colin to beg for the job, right?
Right.
Like if Colin came out and was like, I will never ever talk about justice and I really want to play football, then they'd be like, and there's a team, right? Like, yeah. I think that that would actually happen. And I appreciate that he like won't beg for what he knows is right. Like, I think that that is principled and true and dope and amazing. It'll be interesting too to see what the NFL does. So I've heard that the NFL may come out with some pronouncement soon. That I know the players have been organizing. I know some owners have sort of started to do some things.
Yeah, it kind of goes both ways with the owners. Yeah.
But will that turn into anything? Yeah. Is like the real question. And he, you know, he has that grievance against them for collusion. We'll see if that turns into something. But he is like just a good guy. And he called me like right after he first like didn't stand a year-ish ago. And he was really sweet, and he just like wanted to be plugged into like a larger community of activism, right? So like he wanted to talk to like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and like Mike Brown's mom and like all these other people, and like that was, he wanted to learn, and like that's where he still is. So like the last time I saw him, it was with Piper, who wrote Orange is the New Black. It's like me, him, and Piper. And they had like a great conversation about like criminal justice and like what, you know, Piper still teaches in two prisons in Ohio, and like she teaches writing and she's done it for a long time. And like they had a dope conversation because he like actually wants to understand the issues really well. And he still works out 5 days a week. He trains. He's like ready to be hired any day. Like that is, all of that is true and real.
You know, in the wake of sort of Trump trying to turn this from a conversation around police violence to patriotism, and to sort of suggest that Colin was some, and the other players who were kneeling or whatever, you know, showing protest in some way or during the national anthem, were disrespecting the troops or, you know, whatever it was, you know, some of the, you know, you heard some political commentators say, you know, Trump has, you know, the Democrats or the activists right where he wants them, you know, and the question that was sort of posed was, should Democrats avoid these sort of, you know, quote unquote cultural issues? I don't think cultural is the right way to term it, but it's sort of how it's described in sort of political pundit speak. And, you know, one of the things that I argued at the time was, it's not a question of how do you don't avoid them. You can't avoid them. Trump's president of the United States. People listen when he talks, but like, how do you win him? Right. Like, how do you think you switch the conversation away from, you know, this is a, you know, disrespecting the flag to actually honoring what the flag stands for? You know, how do we get that conversation back in the right direction on this issue?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's so interesting about the left, or not even just the left, is that when you think about, like, when you lie, you have to work really hard. You're trying to come up with, like, the best lie, right? It's, like, tight and like, focused, and you're, like, you already know how you're going to defend it when somebody, like, sort of pushes a little bit. Like, that's, like, that's what you do when you lie. And you think about when you're right, like, sometimes when you're right, you're, like, all over the place because you're right. Like, you know you're right, so you, like, stand in being right more than you stand in sort of, like, a focused message. And I think that's, like, the left, is that because we're right about some of these issues, we play the, like, well, there must be two sides. And it's like, no, most of the things that Trump says aren't two sides. Like, he's lying, you know what I mean? Like, and we should just, like, call it a lie and not be like, well, let's, like, look at the issue. And I think about this with Colin. It's like, Colin said nothing radical, right? It's like, the country was, like, built on racism. A lot of racism still exists. The police are literally killing people, right? Like, all of that is true. Like, that's not actually, like, a radical thing. Wow. And to see the media, like, turn it into this, like, sensationalized thing is actually sort of wild. Like, Colin, there are people saying things that, like, you might just disagree with. Colin didn't. Like, the only thing that Colin said that people take issue with is the, like, you know, his comments about Trump and Hillary sort of saying two sides of the same coin. Like, people sort of get frustrated by that. But everything he said about police or justice was, like, pretty, like, simple. You know, like, they weren't, like...
It's like fact check true.
Like, yeah, you're like, this wasn't really controversial. So... I think that is what I fault the media with a lot, is that, like, they even allowed this to become a patriotism thing, as opposed to, like, Colin literally was just like, there's racism. It's like, no, there is racism, right? Like, the median, I think about this, like, the median wealth of black people in this country in 20 years will be zero. That is crazy.
Like, what? How?
It'll be zero. Like, yeah. Like, well, because it's declining. Like, right. So 20 years after that, Hispanics will be zero. So, like, you're next. But black people are going to be zero in 20 years. It's like, and right now it's, like, already off. So it's like $1,500 to, like, $100,000 for white people. So it's just, like, a wild disparity. But imagine, like, the median wealth being zero. Like, that is only a function of racism. It's not like every black person in the country was like, you know what? I don't want wealth. Like, that didn't happen, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what he's talking about.
And I guess, well, let's, this is sort of a broad question, if you will. But so he, 9 years ago now, almost 9 years ago, Barack Obama was elected president.
Did you work with him then?
I did. I was there. It happened. It seems like a faint mirage in the distance.
Do you have his phone number? Does he have a phone?
He has a phone. I don't have his number.
I mean, I didn't know if he...
We're not going to give it out here. You just told a story about your phone getting hacked. Like,
yeah, somebody could file when I was like, does he have a phone? It's like, I don't know if he has a phone.
Yeah, he has a phone now. He didn't have a phone for a very long time.
See.
He had that BlackBerry.
Whoever made that noise when I was like, does he have a phone?
Yeah. The phone is new. So that happened. Okay. Here we are. Donald Trump is president of the United States. You've had white...
Don't remind us.
Yeah. They all know. They can't forget. Even in San Francisco. Donald Trump is president of the United States. You know, we've had... white supremacists marching in Charlottesville, most notably, but elsewhere. You know, there's been a mainstreaming in some ways of the sort of racist things that many people said. They just didn't say them publicly, didn't say them on TV. And you have Donald Trump calling them fine people or whatever version of, you know, he used to, you know, it all, you know, what does that tell you about the direction America's going in?
I think that they're just really organized. And you think about the right or the white supremacists are really thoughtful about the packaging. So it's like the KKK to the White Citizens Council to the alt-right is the same idea. Like the idea hasn't changed. The packaging has changed. And they're just really good at the repackaging. And when you think about Make America Great Again, that ask is about memory and recall. That we've actually lived in a world where like white supremacists have controlled everything. Like that's not new. So they're just trying to take us back there. Is that a world of equity and justice is a world we've never lived in before. Which is harder for us because we have to like build it and we have to imagine it. We have to agree on it. And then we have to build it, which is like harder work to do in this space. But I'm hopeful that we can do it. I don't think that their mission clearly is wrong. I do think it's easier to focus energy on like bringing us back to a time that's existed already because like, you know, it. I am always fascinated with the way that the mainstream media like validates the way that they show up. So I remember I had Terry McAuliffe on the podcast and McAuliffe is like, they stockpile weapons all through Charlottesville. It's like if we had stockpiled weapons in St. Louis, I would not be here. I'd be like a really cool photo of like in memory of DeRay. Like that would be, would it be if we stockpiled weapons? Like that is so wild to me. And I was at this dinner with Holder. It was like a small thing. And Holder's like, DeRay, the protesters are so amazing. And I'm like, where were you 3 years ago? You weren't saying this 3 years ago, yeah. You know? So that is interesting. The way I think about just how like the conversation about protests has changed in 3 years is like, it's like night and day. When we were out there, we were like villains and people were like, you shouldn't be outside. Now people went to airports and they're like, protest is America. And you're like, okay, well, that's interesting. And there are people who literally think that like the history of injustice in this country began with the Muslim ban, you know? So I think that the question will be post-Trump, like, do people actually care about justice or do people care because they were impacted, right? Like, because he's screwing up everybody, right? So it used to be, it's not just black people anymore. It's like the Muslim ban is screwing up a lot of people. Healthcare is going to screw even more people. Like what he did with birth control. Like he's just, everybody's implicated in a way. So it makes sense that more people are activated. And the question is like, when they're not being targeted like this, like, will they still care about equity and justice? Like that, I think, is like a question that I am thinking about every day.
So we are 5 minutes away from Q&A. So according to the script here, it says start thinking about your question. There's a microphone in the back right corner of the room. Over there is Marissa's pointing. So start lining up now, and in a few minutes we'll start taking questions. That means go line up. All right. So, you know, one thing that I thought is very interesting about your biography is that you decided to run for mayor of Baltimore. And I think that it, you know, that to me, I found that to be an inspiring decision because what you really, you know, we want people to run for office and also make change from within the system as well as push for change without. Sort of what led you to that decision and what advice, you know, I also spent a lot of my time trying to convince other people to run for office.
You gonna run?
No. I live in San Francisco and I'm from Delaware. Like, we got it covered. Like, what caused you to get in that race and what lessons did you learn and what advice would you have for young people about that experience?
Yeah, I think that you have to be as organized on the inside as you're on the outside, that has to be a part of the work, that like part of our strategy has to push systems and structures to be better, but the other part of our strategy has to be like the people inside the system actually doing the work. And most recently I was the chief of human capital in the school system in Baltimore. So I had 50 employees that reported to me. We are a $1.3 billion organization. We employed as many people as the city of Baltimore. And I managed all of our hiring, our health insurance, all these things. And I think about like the power I had every single day to shape an experience for 80,000 kids, 180 schools, 11,000 staff members. And not with little oversight, because like there was a CEO of the school system, but like I just still had a lot of power. And how do we make sure that the people who have those roles are people who already believe in equity and justice, who already care, so we're not like fighting them to think about the way to do it? Like that matters. And I think about when I was the number two in human capital in Minneapolis, is that Minneapolis has a huge achievement gap, wild inequity. Like it's a wealthy city. Like it doesn't have the same, the problems don't show up the same way they show up in other places, but the achievement gap is a huge gap. And when I got there, we were getting complaints about discriminatory hiring practices. So I was like, we'll just interview everybody. Everybody who applies to be a teacher, we'll interview them all. So we did that. And then what we did is that we started asking this question. We asked four questions, but the third question was, do you think that kids from high-need communities can achieve the same grade-level standards as kids from wealthier communities? That's what we asked everybody. And it was like 30% of the people we interviewed said no. They were just like, no. And you're like, okay. This one girl literally said to me, she goes, she's like, DeRay, colored kids just can't, they just can't learn. And I'm like, what? I'm like, and I'm like trying to keep a straight face. And she's like, well, colored kids and, you know, this colored girl. And she's like 25. And I'm just like, I'm like sweating. I'm like, oh my God, I got to get out of here. But it was this lens of like, how do we make sure that we build a system that makes sure that only people who believe that our kids can learn, like actually get in front. And like, I already understood equity and the people around me already understood it. So we were able to build a system like that. Right. And like, that to me is like why it's important that we sit in these positions. So running for mayor was doing that at a different scale. You know, I don't, that was like a wildest thing I've ever done. People were meaner to me when I ran for mayor than anything I've literally ever done in my entire life. I like woke up the next, after I announced, I woke up and there was like this article that was like, the liberation of black people will not come on the back of DeRay McKesson. I'm like,
where'd they even come from? Yeah. What is this? And it's like from a mainstream news. I was like, this is crazy. It's nuts. The New York Times read this. They wrote this article that was like, Duray will not be the next mayor of Baltimore, so why is he running? It was the marquee story for 8 hours that day. I'm like, I'm in an Uber. And this woman's like, I think you're on the front page. And I was like, I know. I'm like, don't read it. Don't read it. Just vote. Don't read it. Just vote. So learned a lot, though, is that I learned that the public is actually not primed for solutions, that people are like used to hearing the problem repeated. So we'd be on panels and it's like 7 of us and somebody would be like, school system's broken. What are you going to do? And literally one by one, people would be like, school system's broken. People like, yeah. And you're like, what are we doing? But like time and time again, like that is what people would do. They'd be like, school system's broken. I'm going to fix it. And people are like, yes. And like, so that was fascinating. Nothing, nothing compares to knocking on doors and calling people. Like there's no amount of forums, no amount of community meetings that will make up for like the actual, like touching people's homes, like nothing. So at the beginning I did these forums because there were a lot of forums. And I think in hindsight, I would have like, we should have just knocked on doors immediately. And then the people that did Bernie's fundraising did mine. So we raised $300,000 in like 60 days. It was more than any race in the country at the time. We raised more money on Twitter than even Bernie had ever raised. So that was really powerful. And like we had donors from all 50 states, but importantly, the third highest number of donors from Baltimore City. So like there was a lot of money coming in, but the city. I learned a ton about campaign finance. So like in Baltimore or Maryland, you can't use debit cards or credit cards in campaigns. So though we raised a lot of money, we still had to, anything that we couldn't be billed for, you had to have it up front. And like, there's so few, like there are not a lot of people who like can have that much cash on hand. So like, we had an Uber account and the Uber account was like linked to our credit card. It was like a nightmare, like it was a logistical nightmare to actually spend money. And I didn't appreciate how those systems privilege people who already have a lot of money just sitting around. Like that was really interesting. And then I also learned a lot about like printing, like the mundane stuff. So like, I didn't know that you have to like always use like a union printer, you know, and if you don't use a union printer,
you're in
like,
big trouble for that.
But the union printer is like, Kinko's is quicker. You know what I mean? Yeah. So you're like, please printer, bring this thing back tomorrow. Like I learned a lot of that. You can get on TV without going through middlemen. Like I learned those things in hindsight that were really powerful. Which was cool and dope. And I got a lot of pushback for like, we did fundraisers in New York, in LA, and like BuzzFeed wrote this article being like, Duray is in a fundraiser in New York. It was like a headline. And I'm like, no, Baltimore doesn't have like $2 million for me to raise in the city. Like if I'm not going to get it from,
that's why I want to be mayor. Right?
Yeah. It's like this one. And now it is cool that people can do fundraisers across the country and it's like, okay. And it's accepted. But I remember when I did it, people were like, it was like, I was a sellout. It was a scandal. And I'm like, oh my God, this is wild. So I learned, if I did it again, there are a lot of things that I would do differently, but proud of what we did. We knocked on a ton of doors, a lot of mailings, a lot of calls, a lot of forms.
Well, I hope you do it again in some form. All right, so we're going to start with questions. And as was indicated, if your question has more periods than question marks, it may be too long. Go for it.
Hi, I'm Alicia. I work in youth activism at Facebook. In my spare time, I'm planning the first annual Black Joy Parade in Oakland. And when I tell people I'm planning it, the first question they ask me is, can only Black people come? And of course, I'm creating it so that Black people can come together, we can celebrate in a positive way, but also be inclusive. Do you have any advice on how to create an organization and a movement that is specifically about one focus and elevating one community, but is inclusive to its allies as well?
Yeah, I think it's only with marginalized people that, like, let me start somewhere else. It is interesting that white people can't imagine things that they can't participate in, right? That's like one of the ways that like white is you can participate in everything because like you've always participated in everything. And that is really the fascinating part of this is that like, so it's really like a, how do we build something that like makes white people okay with like the fact that they might not be able to do it, right? Which again is like this really incredible way that power shows up because like you and I know what it's like to not be like, I know things that I can't do, right? And I've been painfully aware of them for a long time that I'm like not invited, da da da. But like imagine waking up and like you can just participate whatever you want every time. Like that is fascinating. So I think naming that is important.
And then I think that we can just be transparent about, like, there's a goal here. And there are ways that you can align yourself with the goal. Some of it is, like, showing up. Sometimes it's not showing up. Sometimes it's supporting it a different way. Like, I think that that is sort of the language. And understanding that the way that people experience a trauma is just different. So sometimes I need to be around people who've experienced a trauma like I have so that you can help me work through it. In the same way that, like, I conceptually get white guilt, but I don't really – I, like, can't help you process it, right? Like, I could write about it in theory, but, like, you need to be around other white people to, like, help you think through that. Cause, like, I can't do that for you. In the same way that, like, when we think about Black joy, it is often in response to lack of it and, like, the trauma. So, like, we're trying to help people see that we're more than just pain, right? And we're more than just trauma. So, like, I think that is it. But I'm fascinated by the way that whiteness is just used to always being able to participate in every single thing, and that we got to name that better in public.
Next question.
That's so perfect for my question. I'm a white person. My name's Carol. I'm in my 60s. I live here, and I listen to your podcast every week. And to me, I face it with dread because you talk about things that I never knew or understand. I didn't grow up rich, but when you talk about the wealth gap, I'm horrified. And I want to, in some ways, not atone by being a beggar, but do something. I want to do something. Being in San Francisco and marching and being a white woman, Diane, you know, takes our place for that. It's not okay. So, you know, every time I listen to your show and your news part, it's not okay. And it's appalling to me. And I feel like it's inexcusable that I didn't even know about it for 40 years or more. So what can we do? And it's a piece where on your podcast, it's not apparent to me what I can do to help fix these fundamentally huge problems.
I think this is a good push. So two things. One is that we believe that you will never organize around things you don't know. So part of it is, like, how do we help people just, like, know more so they can potentially, like, start to explore on their own and then start to organize. But I'll say that I think that what has not happened in the past 3 years is, like, I think that the interest has far outpaced the capacity to absorb the interest. So there are all these people now who are like, I'm ready to do something. And, like, the organizers just, like, we haven't built something that, like, can absorb that. So you think about, like, your favorite nonprofit, they're either just, like, collecting your email addresses and asking you to donate to them, because that is all they know how to do in this moment, or they can only organize, like, protests and marches at scale. So they can do a lot of things for, like, 30 people, 20 people, but if I tell you have 10,000 people, what they do, like, people don't know. So that's that. So I'll own that. When I think about, like, what the biggest levers are, I think that, like, the system stuff is the only stuff that's going to make, like, an impact at this moment. So, and I believe in programs. I opened up an after-school program. I worked at one of the largest in the country, their Harlem Children's Zones. Like, programs will have a space. People should open up programs. But the things that will have, like, the single biggest impact, so, like, felony, you probably heard this on the podcast, but, like, what is a felony? Is that people think about felons as, like, the worst criminals. Every felon has killed 10 people, blown up a building. But you think about places like Virginia where, like, theft over $200 is a felony. So that's, like, an iPhone, a bike, a pair of shoes. And in Virginia, you lose the right to vote permanently when you become a felon, right? So you think about, like, those sort of things are the things that, like, we are trying to figure out how to get people to, like, mobilize around and change at the system level, because that would impact way more people than any of the smaller stuff. Or, like, with the wealth gap, it's like white people don't have wealth because they just, like, worked really, really hard. They have wealth because the government literally gave them wealth, gave them homes. Like, the single biggest asset you can have is, like, housing, those sort of things. So, like, what would it look like to take every community that we redlined and, like, impacted negatively, and we drew, like, a green line around it, and we started greenlining neighborhood. Like, that, to me, those are the solutions. So we are trying to figure out, like, how to map them out and then give you, like, an easy way to plug in so that you can start doing it. But I think you're right about what the challenge is. On the podcast, the goal was, like, if we believe that if we expose more people to more issues, they will know more, and knowing more is, like, the first step to doing more. And that you aren't born woke, something wakes you up. And we want the podcast to be a place where, like, you get woke about something. And I think about me, it's like, I saw Mike Brown's death on the news and it changed my life, right? So we're hoping that people will, like, see these things and they'll hear them and they'll start to organize around them. But we also are trying to build this portal that, like, will allow people to plug in differently. And I also, this last thing I'll say, is that I grew up in clubs and organizations and I don't want to join another thing, right? I'm, like, sort of joined out.
which doesn't mean that I don't care. I think there are a lot of people in this room who, like, you're probably not going to an organizing meeting every Wednesday night because your life just isn't set up like that. But it doesn't mean that you don't care. And we need to figure out how to, like, how to create space for those people to do incredible work. Like, I think that has to be a part of what we do next.
Hi, Duray. You mentioned the changing public perceptions of protest. I'm a graduate student at Berkeley, where for much of this year, it feels like every month our city and our campus is taken over by, on one hand, out-of-town pro-Trump protesters or sort of invited speakers who are like white nationalists. And there's Berkeley being Berkeley. Of course, there are huge counter-protests. You know, the community, the students, the faculty come together. And these counter-protests are sort of increasingly, it feels like, dismissed as being anti-free speech by the university, by right-wing media, even by sort of, you know, normal center-left people. And so I'm wondering, what do you think are effective methods of counter-protesting? And then also, what's an effective response to this anti-free speech claim that people are making?
Yeah, it's interesting because people never talk about protests as free speech, but I think about protests as the freest speech of all, right? And like, I should be able to do it at 3 a.m. I shouldn't have to stand in a corner and do it. Like, I want my free speech to be free, right? Like, and I think about protests as that. I think that one of the things that we saw in Ferguson that was like really powerful is that we did, there were two women who organized a protest on Easter, like the first, I think it was the first Easter after Mike had been killed. I think it was the first Easter, yeah. And it was a silent protest. Like, we stood out in front of churches and, like, hummed Wade in the Water. It was, like, incredible. And it was this thing that, like, people had expected us to show up and, like, shout and scream and, like, we're humming, right? And, like, people just didn't know what to do. So the police look crazy, like, sort of arresting Hummer. You know, it's like, we're humming, right? Like, that's sort of weird. And, like, the church people, like, it just, and we were trying to call out the fact that the churches hadn't mobilized. And, like, I'd be interested to think about, like, what are the different ways to use people's bodies in public spaces that, like, carrying the signs and all that stuff is, like, one way to do it, right? I remember when I was in college, people with sidewalk chalk. Like, there are other ways that you can use the numbers to, like, create a different picture that forces people to respond in a different way. And I think that that is one of the things that, like, the protesters in St. Louis did incredibly well. Like, I remember one night people drove around and spray painted racism, like, this way to racism on, like, all the streets, like, in the middle of the street, you know what I mean? It was, like, racism this way, you know? And it was, like, this idea that, like, the whole city is racist, but all of a sudden, all across St. Louis, you saw these things, like, spray painted. And, like, that is, like, just a different way to, like, get this message out. So that would be my challenge to you, is, like, think about a different way to use people's bodies that isn't always, like, sort of speaking in the same way.
So I was working at one point in time with Sean King. We were working on kind of the divestment that was going on around the Dakota Access Pipeline in Seattle, also in San Francisco. And we were having some success, you know, translating kind of digital activism into activism in real life. But I would love to hear from you about what strategies, what things have worked for you in terms of doing both a digital activism and then also in real life to try to make systemic change, since just showing up is not going to do it.
Yeah, so showing up is important, though. And I'll never criticize, like, the, you know, people are like slacktivists. Is that, like, I don't care where you tell the truth. I just want you to tell the truth, right? And some people, Twitter is the place they do it. Some people sit down around a table. Like, wherever you tell the truth, like, people should be telling the truth. And, like, that's really important. Is that the best organizers are relationship builders. And technology doesn't change that. So some people can build relationships really well online. Some people can build them really well offline. And some people can figure out how to transition in between those two spaces. But the people who think that technology is going to, like, replace relationship building, like, I think that those are the people who, like, don't get what it means to organize. So in terms of, like, what are the most effective is, like, when we did it in St. Louis, we used Twitter as a way to, like, share messages quickly, get people to come to a spot, and, like, sort of get people on the same page about, like, the mission really quickly. It didn't replace the fact that when we got to the space, like, somebody had to tell you where to go, right? And, like, somebody had to tell you, like, what order and those sort of things. So I've seen, like, Twitter be an amazing, like, mobilizer, an amazing share of information. Excuse me. I think that the offline organizing will have to still be, like, the key, though, in terms of pushing people to act differently, because some people, like, only respond to the offline space. I think that we're just in the beginning, though. I'm mindful of the civil rights movement was a decade, right? We're in year three. So I think that the tech solution around organizing hasn't been built yet. Like, I think it's not here yet.
Hi. I went to UVA. And so this past summer, watching everything go down in Charlottesville. It was incredibly hard, but also heartening to see all my friends and professors who were still in town on the side of the protest against the rallies. But it's brought to mind, as was previously mentioned, with the free speech rallies that were in Berkeley and even Richard Spencer this week at the University of Florida. It seems that the alt-right are sort of co-opting the amorphous, unorganized organization model that has been spearheaded here and are, in fact, looking for the counter-protest as the actual end goal of their events. Mm-hmm. How do we avoid playing into their trap, for lack of a better phrase? How do we not give them what the optics that they want? You know, it's somewhat addressed, but how do we, you know, sort of move and try and interact with them? Is there anything we can do beyond, as you were saying, the just sort of one-on-one educate and just make people more aware?
Yeah, I think it's important that people see that people want to be counted, like that people don't agree with them. I would push, just like I said before, about like there are different ways to do it. So I think about in St. Louis, there was, if you remember when people like started singing at one of the performances, this was like early, it was like August or September, like a set of protesters got into like a performance and then started like at the opera or whatever and started singing like a song about Mike Brown. Like that was like really powerful and like, that's really cool. I remember one day we shut down an intersection. It was, there's a chant that people don't really chant anymore, but in the beginning it was, they think it's a joke, they think it's a game. Like that was the chant. And so we shut down an intersection by playing games. Like it was like hopscotch and like Foursquare, because we knew that like the police weren't going to arrest like a 60-year-old woman hopscotching, right? Like it just like looked crazy. But it was a way that we could like use our bodies differently, because the police had just planned for us to just shut down the street by sitting down. And we're like, no, people playing like monkey in the middle. And it was like super organized, right? Like we bought all these toys. We bought like $500 worth of toys. We bought a ton of toys. Like, and people like legitimately played and shut down this huge intersection. And the police came up like they were going to do something. And they just like relaxed, because like, what were they going to do, right? I think it'd be interesting with like Richard Spencer. It's like, what if everybody comes into a theater and like just turns the other way, right? Like things that like don't give him the energy that he wants, but still makes it really clear that people don't agree. I think there are like a million ways that you can do that. And like, I don't know if I would have believed it if I hadn't seen it, but I saw it in St. Louis and was like, this is incredible. One of the most powerful things we'd ever done is there was one night where we got like 3,000-ish people in one spot. We split them up into two groups, and there were only like seven of us that knew where we were going. And like, they just told me, they're like, we're going to the fountain, and I'm not from St. Louis, and I didn't know what the fountain was. I'm like, yeah, I'll meet you at the fountain. But we split these two groups up, and we split everybody up. Like, the media got split up. Everybody got split into two groups. Our group was a little slower, so this one group gets to like how to go to the fountain. It was an Occupy salute, and they have to cross this bridge, and the police like blocked the bridge. Like they just like shut the bridge down. So we get these texts being like, can't cross the bridge, da, da, da. And the police, they don't know where we're going though. We literally flank on the other side, and it's like 3,000 people closing the police in, and they just like fall back, right? And it was this amazing moment of like organizers organizing, and like the police had never seen that before, and we didn't feed into what they wanted. They wanted like this conflict, but it was 3,000 of us and like 100 of them, right? So they just like fell back. And I think that like my challenge would be like, I think we need to be more creative about how we use people's bodies in spaces, because I think that we can do it in a way that doesn't feed into them.
These are our last two questions.
First of all, thank you so much for facing death threats and bullying and continuing on with your work. There is some thought that America will not heal until reparations are made for slavery. I was wondering what your feeling is about that, your thoughts.
Yeah, I think about reparations, this idea of acknowledge and repair, that the word is like a lightning rod for people, but the idea is the right idea, right? It's like acknowledge the historical wrongdoings and fix them. And I think we have to start thinking about reparations as like more than cash. Like people think that if you poll people, like they think about it as like a blank check or 40 acres and a mule. But you think about literacy, it's like, what if we gave every single kid born in poverty a set of library books from birth to 12th grade? Like that would be a way to correct for like what happens when you've never grown up in a house with words, not because like your family didn't care, but because they were not allowed to read. And like, that's what I want us to think about with our, what would it look like to take every neighborhood that was redlined and like draw a green line around it and like over invest in those communities, because they're literally the same communities. Like that is actually the acknowledgement and repair. And like, I think that is what we need to start thinking about, that it's not just like you could give every black person like $50,000 and it wouldn't make a dent in the wealth gap, right? Like the wealth would still be low. Is that the systemic stuff is the stuff that like is actually going to be a game changer. And like, that is what I think reparations will be in the end.
Last question.
Hi. So as an Asian American, I face my own struggles with racism. And I guess I'm very lucky to have grown up in the Bay Area, which is a very diverse place. But in light of, you know, all the ugly things that have come out in this last year with racism, I'm wondering if you think that it is more helpful for, or in terms of how non-black minorities should organize, is it better that we organize separately and, you know, face our own struggles because we all have very different problems? Or do you see it more as a movement that's not necessarily monolithic, but it's just a fight, you know, just being fought on different fronts?
I think it's going to take all of us to win. That, like, just from a practical standpoint, we don't have the numbers, right? Like, there's just not enough of us alone. So when I think about what coalitions are saying, like, we have a shared vision of what the end goal is. We might differ about how we get there. So, like, your issues might be different from mine in, like, the minutiae, but in the long term, it's like we all want to live in a world of equity and justice. And I think about freedom as not only the absence of oppression, but the presence of justice and joy. And so much of the resistance space is focused on the absence of oppression, right? We're like, let's make sure that we mitigate the harm and da-da-da. But we also have to make sure that we're, like, the builders, too. Because what we don't want to do is get rid of all the bad stuff. And then, like, the only people that have the skills to build are the people that built the bad stuff we just got rid of. Like, that is a, it's not a good win. So when I think about coalitions, it's like we agree on the end. We might disagree or differ about the tactics to get there, but like coalitions, we got to do it. That like they're not enough of us alone, and that when I'm free, we all are free. And I think that we've never seen white people mobilize like this before, and that if we don't figure out how to like take that energy, take all the people of color and like move that towards some end goal that makes sense, I think that we'll struggle. I think that one of the reasons why people love Bernie is that Bernie sort of like skipped the how and he just went right to the what, right? Like he painted this picture for people about what the world could be. Questionable with the how, and that's not even a knock to Bernie. I like Bernie. It was questionable with the how. You know, he's like, I'm gonna free like millions of people from federal prison. You're like, there aren't millions of people in federal prison, Bernie. He's,
but if there were. He's,
yeah. Right. You're like, okay, but I got you, right? But like people like the vision. Whereas Hillary was like, all how, and people struggle with the what. And like the what was there, it just, I think that they just didn't figure out how to package it well. But I say that because that's what people want in this moment. I think that people are tired of pep talks. People are tired of like whatever. They want a plan. They want a plan and a way to like plug into the plan. Like that's what people want. And I think that it'll take all of us being a part of it to make it a win.
All right. So one final question for you.
Oh.
Yeah. This is a informed tradition.
Okay.
So be ready for this. They we ask every guest, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
I think that we figure out how to use technology to absorb all the energy and assign people to work that makes the most sense for who they are and track that work at scale so that your chapter, the chapter that you belong to is the internet, that the organization you belong to is the world, like that we figure out how to do that. Because I think that people don't want to necessarily, I think that there is a style of organizing that says you have to be a member of things. There's another style of organizing that says that you are already a member of something.
All right. So... Thank you, DeRay. You know, I think, you know, I certainly will. I think people here are going to walk out of this room, like my old boss used to say, fired up and ready to go. And that's a pretty big achievement in these dark days. So thank you so much.
I'll be around. Cool. Thank you, guys. Done.